Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Hey everybody, you want to know what we found in the Vault Conspiracy? Quickly before they catch up to me, there's a fascinating podcast that I need to tell you about before they catch up to me. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited, hosted by Richard Syrett. If you enjoy mind-blowing mysteries, little-known facts, true crime stories, alternate history, and the paranormal, you'll want to check out this podcast quickly. The website is conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. That's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Here they come. Run, everybody. Go.
Now, today we have the award-winning investigative journalist, Russ Baker. Now, he's written for major news organizations all around the world, including the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and Esquire. His book is The Family of Secrets. It's The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He's also the founder and editor-in-chief of the groundbreaking news site whowhatwhy.org. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Al. Good to be here.
So, you know, I find that the Who, What, Why website's fantastic. So now you've started this website, and this is kind of an information place. This gives you the news, and it's based on truth.
Yeah, the background is whowhatwhy.org. We are a nonprofit. We don't have any investors involved, and in fact, we don't even accept any advertising. We're quite a purist venture, you might say. It's the outgrowth of my many years working in journalism and being frustrated by what I perceived to be an inability to tell the entire truth of what I found as a reporter. So I started Who, What, Why, and our mission is basically to provide the public with much better, more accurate, deeper journalism that explains to them what's going on in the world, how it affects them, and really gets to the deeper currents, you might say, that run beneath sort of superficial events.
So what do you think's gone on with the mainstream media? Why is it that they've sort of stayed away from being too honest, I guess is the best way to say it?
Well, simply put, when you're a journalist, you rely on a steady stream of material from sources, so you need access you need, whether you cover the Pentagon, you need people there to give you leaks and so forth, or tips or handouts or whatever. And so there's already a problem, a compromising going on there that prevents you from doing your best work. And that's always been the case. The other issue is the ownership of the media. Almost all of the major media organizations are parts of larger giant corporations with other arms doing all kinds of things. And so, for example, historically, if you worked for NBC or MSNBC or something, you had a relationship to General Electric, which was a giant military contractor, and you would see that NBC historically was tended to be much more sort of gung-ho about wars than even other outfits like CBS. CBS, you know, tied in with another large, with a Viacom, another large company owning all kinds of things. And so they need, for example, government approvals for various kinds of broadcasting licenses and things like that. And so there are a lot of agendas going on that, although the reporters, they try to protect the reporters from this stuff, you can't work at these places without being aware of who signs your paycheck.
Well, doing what you do then, do you find that there's a little, it's quite difficult to get your own sources?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. The way we do our work at Who, What, Why, our ambition, by the way, is to have the budget, and this is all entirely dependent on whether the public, individuals, like listeners to this show, decide that they want to support and see this kind of thing succeed. If we can raise the funds, what we want to do is we want to have a large team of investigative reporters really digging. And with a good investigative reporter, you don't need those handouts. You don't need the PR people from the company or the government agency handing you stuff, because you can find it on your own with enough shoe leather work, basically. But for now, because of our limited resources, we tend to do a lot of what I would call investigative analysis or investigative thinking. And so what we'll do is we'll get a hold of whatever documents we can, some of which are available publicly. Sometimes we'll do a Freedom of Information request, and we'll try to talk to people who are willing to be open, who might not have a stake in spinning the story, and we'll do it that way. And we've had a very, very good response. Our readership is growing steadily, and we find that on stories like, let's take, for example, all the wars that the United States is involved in, whether under a Republican or a Democratic administration. Why is that? And so we've been able to do analysis to explain the influences upon the Defense Department, and then from the Defense Department upon the presidents, to sort of follow along in lockstep, and whether they want to or not. I think a president like Obama has wanted to resist a little bit, hasn't found a way to do it. Now at the end of his presidency, he's finally starting to do it a little bit more. But they kind of know that they see the writing on the wall, and so we're able to analyze these things and figure out, connect the dots, figure out what's going on. And in stories like our early reporting on Libya and the real reason that the United States and the West wanted to overthrow Gaddafi, which had nothing to do with human rights, even though the public was told that, or the real reason that the United States and the West want to go in and overthrow Assad in Syria, which have nothing to do with his human rights record again. The real reason that the United States went into Iraq, interesting to see Donald Trump raising that of all people. And so there's, you know, we're getting falsehoods, Al, on so many different fronts. The public, you know, when they hear the kind of things we have to say, they're startled almost, and they say, oh my gosh, you're saying there's a completely different reality out there, and the answer is yes, there is.
Yeah, there's a real hunger for it. You can see by social media how many people are looking for answers or looking for truth. I don't know, is there something about the way we elect our government, maybe?
Well, sure. I mean, it all goes back to the influence of money. I think whatever people may think, if they like or don't like Bernie Sanders, is that he is talking about something very real, which is that in our society, and I think to some extent in all societies, but maybe more profoundly in our society, money calls the shots. And if you got a lot of money, you can hire all the top lawyers. You're friends with people like the late Antonin Scalia. You can get him to come out to your ranch and so forth. And you're able, in certain ways that maybe are not illegal or don't, are not so transparently unethical, but they come very, very close to the line. You're able to sort of shave things to change the odds and so forth. And so that's really the way that so many things work. You know, what that means is that the government itself, you know, here we are in a presidential year, and all of our whatever time and energy we have to devote to news is practically devoted to this horse race and the excitement of who's up and who's down. There's almost no coverage, if you look at the news, about policy, about the laws and regulations and other things that actually would affect us in our lives and our world. And instead, it's all about who's up each day and who's down. And that is because it's fun, and we enjoy it, and we take the path of least resistance, and the media understands that. And media, to a large extent, is an entertainment vehicle, and sadly more so than a public service, and they've got to respond to what the public likes. It's kind of like asking somebody, would you rather eat broccoli or ice cream? Well, we know the answer, but we also know what's good for you. And so that's really the problem, that the coverage of the campaign is about a horse race, a beauty contest, not really about who these people actually are, who's behind them, who's giving them money, what they would want to do when they're in office, and even more importantly, what could they do when they're in office? Because this reality that whether it is a somebody like a Cruz or somebody like Hillary Clinton, when they get in, I mean, they've taken so much money from these Wall Street interests and these banks and these military contractors that they're in a very difficult position. They've already fundamentally compromised, and those people want and expect certain things, and it may not be in the power or the willpower of these candidates when they get elected to resist. And so the notion that we live in a democracy where we're well-informed and we decide, we listen to the candidates and decide which of them say things that resonate for us, and then we pick those people, and then those people do what we want. We are so incredibly far away from that as a reality, and I think that's the conversation we have to have in this country.
Yeah, I've been saying that. It seems like all they talk about is Hillary's emails or what Donald Trump has said to offend whoever. And there's just not a whole lot of substance going on.
There really isn't. And, you know, even those issues, and I guess you're in Arizona, so this is an important issue there, even the issue of immigration is distorted. Whatever you think of it, and there are reasonable arguments all over the place on that, different sides, but even the facts we get are not correct. I was surprised to see a study showing that the actual immigration into this country coming from Mexico is way down and has been down for years, and that a larger percentage even of the people coming from Mexico are actually rather affluent and educated. And so I was astonished by that. I mean, how come we're not getting that information?
News tends to be more entertainment. It's more about the person and how they look, and they present things like it's Kardashian or something.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the other thing is that candidates and news organizations understand that what push people's buttons, what get them excited, is conflict. Whether it's movies or it's anything else, conflict is always an important factor. And if we look at these campaigns, these ideas that it's this versus that, whether it's about immigration or it's about marriage equality or it's about abortion or whatever, it's always pitting one side against the other, you know, the pro-choice versus pro-life, the mother versus the life of the baby, and so on. And so everything is kind of reduced that way when the truth is it's much more complex. And complex, or somebody said the other day to me, you know, the media doesn't do nuance very well.
Where did all this start, do you think? Because back in the 60s and 70s and that, it didn't seem to be so extreme, so polarized.
That's true. My sense, and there are a number of different things about this, is that there are people and elements who benefit from this kind of fracturing of our society. And at whowhatwhy.org, our site, and in my book, Family of Secrets, which is about 50 years of unexamined goings-on in American history, I focus, and we focus very heavily, on the rigging of the system, on how a small number of people and institutions manage to always stay on top, despite the fact that they're really very few in number, and despite the fact that we supposedly live in a democracy, or as some people would say, a republic. And so I'm very interested in that. And if you go back, there are certain benchmarks. For example, in, I want to say 1971, I could have the year wrong, Lewis Powell, who would then later be named to the Supreme Court, was a corporate attorney, and he wrote a memo saying that if the corporations and the wealthy wanted to get the upper hand, they needed to resist these sort of equality movements that were going on in the country, these efforts to sort of level the playing field, and that the trick was, as he put it, to defund the left. And what he meant by that was that there were all these growing institutions, there was a certain amount of philanthropy, formerly very traditional families like the Fords and the Rockefellers, who were moving as the money passed from one generation to another more and more into trying to do some things to sort of rectify imbalances of income and other things in society and justices. And so they saw this all with alarm, and they said that the net effect of all of this is going to be that you're going to have a leveling of the playing field, which is bad for us, meaning them. And so they talked about what to do about it, and they hit on a whole bunch of ideas, including funding. They saw that most of the think tanks were so-called liberals, so they created things like the Heritage Foundation. They perceived the media, they would always describe the media as liberal, which I don't think it ever really was. It was always corporate and moderate. But they created things like Fox News and the New York Post and the Weekly Standard or what have you. So they saw that a lot of professors were what they perceived to be liberal or left, although it was mostly in rhetoric, and a lot of what the professors taught was really not anywhere as radical as they presented it. And so they then began funding endowed chairs at universities for conservatives, for people who were much more sympathetic to the viewpoint of the very wealthy. And so they began this massive effort to do all that, and at the same time, they realized they had a problem with elections, which is, if you ask people, do you want to vote for the person who wants to have people who do extremely well pay a larger share than those who are suffering and are struggling on almost nothing, most people would support that. And so they said, well, we're going to lose in these elections, so what do we do? And what they came up with, Al, was this divide and conquer strategy, which was basically to create hot-button social issues that would divide people and would dominate these elections and get them to focus away from the kind of thing, let's say Sanders is talking about the 1%, and to focus instead on, I disagree with these people over abortion, or I disagree with them over gay rights or what have you. And it was very, very effective, and it's been very effective. It's still very effective in this election. And we see very often people voting for candidates who actually are not necessarily advocating things that would personally benefit them, but they like what they say on these controversies. And that, I think, has been a tremendously powerful instrument to keep political control in the hands of very, very few people.
But you can't vote for a candidate if they're standing against something you believe in. It kind of leaves it whether they believe it or not.
Well, let's take an example. Let's say you are you're an auto worker, and you work your whole life for a company, and you've got a pension, and you're looking forward to Social Security, and you've got a mortgage and some other things, and suddenly everything starts going off the rails. The company announces that they were having financial trouble, and your pension is no longer your pension. And you discover that something is problematical with your mortgage, as in 2008, and suddenly you find yourself losing your home, and you see that Social Security is not properly funded, and so suddenly you're terrified and you have nothing. But at the same time, there is this strong person, whether it's a Trump or whatever, a strong orator, telling you to feel proud about yourself and about America, and that's very appealing. Waving the flag, singing songs, these kinds of things have always been used to manipulate people's emotions, because it doesn't take any thinking to respond to something visceral like that. And so you might well support somebody, even though a Donald Trump really, in many respects, is never a guy who's cared about the average person. You know, at our website, whowhatwhy.org, you can watch a suppressed documentary. He sued to prevent this documentary from being released, but it interviews people who worked for him, and it interviews his executives and other people, people who lost their homes as a result of dealing with him, and about what kind of a person he was. And so here he is rallying a base which is largely working people who don't understand that if you look at his own track record, he was never in their corner. It's just that he's saying things about, I'm going to kick ass and make, pardon my French, and make America strong, and it sounds good to them.
I sort of think that isn't he really part of the rich elite that people are upset with, that, so you know, he's a billionaire, so.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you look at the candidates, he's a billionaire, but I mean, you know, if you look at a guy like Ted Cruz, okay, they came from modest backgrounds, but I mean, you know, Ted Cruz's wife was an executive with Goldman Sachs, and he and his voting record in Washington is totally in line with what the big corporations want. Marco Rubio, you know, and on and on. And so you don't see generally, I think out of all the candidates, you know, Hillary Clinton getting paid enormous sums to give speeches to Goldman Sachs. I mean, if you look at all of them, as far as I know, Sanders is financially modest resources. That may be true of a few of the candidates who dropped out. I'm not sure about Huckabee and so on. But, you know, by and large, these are not people who personally relate very well to somebody who brings home a paycheck and who struggles, you know, from week to week.
When you hear stories about, let's say, the Illuminati and the Rockefellers and stuff, do you have a problem finding the truth and what's kind of conspiracy?
Yeah, so that issue of that term conspiracy is one of great interest to me and to all the people at whowhatwhy.org. Because you can almost divide the populace into sort of two groups, if you will. One that you might call conspiracy theorists, and the other you might call coincidence theorists. And it really is, you know, a large segment of the population believes what they are told, and they don't question who's telling them or how they know or who it benefits. And then there's another segment of the population, I think it's a smaller but growing segment, that really is convinced that everything is a lie and that everything is being manipulated. And unfortunately, neither of those are very healthy, because good mental health is your ability to discern, to distinguish. And so you know, for example, that you know, if Wall Street almost singularly supports a candidate, there's a reason for it, but that reason may not be benign, whereas if almost every scientist in the world says that climate change is real, that's not the same thing. In other words, just because you could be suspicious of why extremely wealthy people all support one candidate is not the same thing as to why hundreds of thousands of or millions of scientists in all different disciplines and employed in different places would all agree about something. And so, you know, it's important to trust some people, some journalists. When you go to the doctor, if you are suspicious of your doctor and you really can't trust them, you've got a problem. You know, some doctors can't be trusted, but you've got to find the one to trust. And so this issue of conspiracy in this word is a problem, because the system has managed to take legitimate doubts and to put a pejorative on it, to put a negative term and wrap it around it, and to try to label as kooks people who are really asking very legitimate questions. And, you know, I invite you and your listeners to go to whowhatwhy.org and look at just, you know, in the search box, just type in Boston Marathon. I mean, as a very serious news organization with people working for us who have experience and qualifications and are intelligent, we looked at the Boston Marathon bombing and were disturbed by the way that the press so quickly accepted a statement made by the FBI so quickly that they had wrapped the whole thing up. There were a whole bunch of loose threads, a whole bunch of things that didn't add up, statements that were contradictory to each other, and so we suspected that we were maybe not getting the whole story. Now, it's very easy to label somebody as a kook who says we're not getting the whole story, but we often don't get the whole story. We know in retrospect we didn't get the whole story about so many different things from the Kennedy assassination to Iran-Contra, to on and on and on. It has been established that we were lied to. And outfits like the FBI and the Justice Department and so on, we know that all these outfits' instincts are to protect their own posterior, to protect their own interests. That's what corporations and groups and sort of organizations do. They protect their own interests. And so we began looking at the Boston Marathon bombing, and we found all kinds of problems, starting with the fact that the FBI had a personal relationship with the elder of the two brothers, who were ultimately determined to have been responsible for the bombing. And that whole thing was swept under the rug. They were forced to admit it, but the media failed to pursue that. And so all alone, and I believe the whole world's media, Who, What, Why, published about 70 articles raising questions as to whether we got the whole story. Now, some people will take that reporting and therefore say that, oh, the Boston Marathon bombing was what you call a false flag attack, and that all the people who appeared to be injured were actors. Well, that's just lunacy. We know that people were injured. We know that people were killed. We know who they were. We know that they now have stumps. And so those who go out on the other side and say, don't believe anything at all, and it's all a lie, I don't trust those people at all, and I think they're either insane or stupid, or they themselves are disinformation agents for the entities that want to cover up what actually happened. And do you see what I mean? It's two extremes, neither of them good.
Right. Now, the media, in general, just following script, basically reporting, yeah, this is what happened, and not really investigating, is that something that's just come along now or new? Because I have to wonder, with the Kennedy assassination and the whole Warren Commission thing seemed almost like a whitewash, and there seemed to be no backlash from the media.
Well, that's right. In fact, this book I wrote, Family of Secrets, it's nominally about the Bush dynasty, but it's actually about 50 years of all of these events, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, the relationship, growing relationship with the Saudis, all of these things. What are these things all about? And I spent 5 years working on that, and I dug and I dug and I dug out, and I started finding connections that really made sense and that explained in a more cohesive way what has been going on in our country. And I became interested in the Kennedy assassination, something I knew nothing about, other than that I had been led to understand that Lee Harvey Oswald had killed Kennedy. Most people, you know, have never really dug into that. And so I discovered a very odd thing about George H.W. Bush, the Bush 41, the father of George W. Bush, also president. And I discovered that he had led a secret life long before he was CIA director, that he had actually been a CIA operative throughout his adult life. It's all documented in Family of Secrets. And I discovered that a lot of his doings in Texas in the 50s and the 60s merited more scrutiny. One of the things I found was that in an interview, when they had asked him a very benign, sort of softball question, what do you remember about the day Kennedy was shot, and where were you when you heard that he was shot, he sort of panicked, and he didn't answer the question. And I was so fascinated by that, Al, that I decided to figure out, where was George H.W. Bush when Kennedy was shot? Why can't he remember? And so this took me down what really was a kind of a rabbit's hole. And I spent years looking at this stuff, and I became so interested in the Kennedy assassination. In Family of Secrets, there's 5 chapters of all new information on the Kennedy assassination, how the removal of various presidents and threats to other presidents are part of a larger rubric of power networks, which makes perfect sense, whether it's elements in the military or in the spy agencies, the relationships to large corporations and wealthy individuals and networks, and how they not only seek, as we know, to overthrow foreign leaders who displease them or threaten their investments, but how they do it in this country as well. And so when I saw that, I was like, holy smokes, I know nothing about our country. I understand nothing about how this all works. And these people who are dismissed as conspiracy kooks may not be kooks at all. And so I then started looking at the media, the point that you raised, and I said, oh my gosh, the media is totally complicit in this stuff. They are putting out one whitewash after another. The Warren Commission, not a real investigative commission, set up strictly to whitewash the whole thing, just like the 9/11 Commission and all these other commissions we've seen. And I began to realize that, you know, it is true, the things that some people say, that the 1% have this whole deck stacked. The media is largely complicit. It does good work, but it does good work only on certain things and on very modest things where they're not afraid that they're going to lose their job or metaphorically get their head cut off. And so, you know, we can maybe count on the media for certain things and for the weather and certain investigative reporting. We cannot count on it to dig deep enough into what really makes our world and to really understand how things work. That for that we need to create new media, and that is why I started whowhatwhy.org, and that's why I made it a nonprofit funded only by the kind of people who, you know, listen to your program, and not to take any ads at all.
Do you get funding then from listeners? Readers?
Yeah, all of our funding comes just from regular folks, and on our website, whowhatwhy.org, you can click on a thing that says donate, and it takes you to a page where people give whatever they can, whatever they want. You know, we've had donations from $1 to $100,000, you know, and it's really whatever somebody can do. You can give, sign up to give a fixed amount per month or whatever, and the fascinating thing is that most of our funding comes from people with very, very modest resources. We hear from people all the time who a nurse, a steel worker, what have you, people who own a small business, an accountant, and so on, and they say, I just love this. It's so refreshing. For years, I felt alone, that there's something wrong with me, and my friends or my spouse would dismiss my concerns that we weren't getting the truth, and so they're delighted to discover us, and they are us. We are them. We work for the public, and that's why that whole structure is designed to have all the funding only come from people who are interested in the truth.
These people running for president, are we really choosing who's going to be the leader, or is it something that's sort of predestined?
Well, you know, you mentioned this thing about whatever you said about the this notion of elites and organized things and so on. Look, certainly there are organizations that people belong to, and in my book Family of Secrets, I go into, for example, Skull and Bones. I talk a little bit about the Freemasons. I mean, people, human beings, join things to get power. That's really why people do most things. You know, if people sort of, you know, volunteer for a good cause, they're looking to meet people. I'm not saying they don't want to do the right thing or and so forth, but, you know, you join the board of the art museum, you're doing it in part for status, in part because you meet other wealthy people, deals happen and things like that. That's, you know, nobody talks about that stuff, but that's the truth. So people join things like become, Scottish Rite Temple members or this or that. In part, they're looking for sort of learning and higher purpose, but in part because they've heard that it's good for your career. So they join these things. Now, a lot of these things, they have sort of rituals and they have, you're sworn to secrecy. Well, in an environment like that, that creates a kind of a hothouse environment for all kinds of schemes and underhanded things and plots, because you're not allowed to tell on your fellow members. And John F. Kennedy, by the way, I mean, he was up against many of these interests. He was never a member of these things. And he actually gave a speech where he warned about the influence of secret societies. And so we have a very real reason to be concerned, but not just secret societies. We have a concern about public societies, entities like the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, you know, would I go if they invited me? Sure, it would be interesting. Would I go to Davos in Switzerland, World Economic Forum? Yeah, of course, because it would be extremely interesting. But I'm not naive as to think that people who go to those things don't go because they are attempting to form, not only to learn and to do deals, but to form a consensus with other people to establish commonalities and to agree on the way ahead on things that will benefit them. And so I don't know that we need to see it all as, you know, I think there's a tendency in a part of that kind of conspiracy world to see everything as very neat, that it's a like a scene out of that movie Eyes Wide Shut, you know, that it's a small group of people muttering incantations and wearing weird robes and having, you know, deviant sexual practices to bond them in. You know, I'm sure there's some of that, but more often than not, that's not how it works. People are hanging out together at the country club, and they're talking about, you know, they don't like Obama and how can he be damaged or whatever it is, or whoever they don't like, and that's the way of the world.
Well, in your book, Family of Secrets, how did you find George W. Bush got into power when he didn't really have the best young person record?
Well, you know, Al, that is a great question. That is exactly the question that spurred me to begin researching the Bush dynasty. And I know that with Jeb losing so ignominiously, it's very easy to sort of conclude that we don't need to study that family. But I think that's a huge mistake, because there's so much to be learned about them. What we're really looking at is an extremely undistinguished family that served the wealthy so effectively that the wealthy rewarded them. And my investigations over the course of 5 years for Family of Secrets helped me sort of unearth this network of wealthy people behind them. And I think that, you know, George W. Bush, I mean, he was a... he had a certain amount of charisma, unlike Jeb, and he was, you know, and he was able to perform pretty well, and that helped him. The father had certain types of charisma as well, even though the father himself was a kind of an inarticulate and ineffectual man in certain ways. But really what we see is that they were masters because they had so much money from the wealthy. They were able to hire people like Karl Rove, who were smart enough to see these people's defects and to hide them or distract them. And so in my book, Family of Secrets, I go into all these tricks that they use to distract the public. And so, for example, I have a whole chapter on George W. Bush being born again, where I find one of their advisors who basically shows me the memos he wrote where he was trying to convince them to become or to say that they were born again in order to win. We see how when there was attention, you know, how saying he was born again allowed them to clear the slate. So what you talked about, Al, is what he was like as a man up until he decided to get into politics, and how his track record was so unimpressive, to put it mildly. How they were able to use being born again as, you know, evangelicals, except that everything before that moment doesn't matter. It was a perfect thing to do. It was quite brilliant, actually. And so we see again and again when his embarrassing military records started coming out, they went on the offensive. They just decided to try to destroy John Kerry, who did not have an embarrassing military record, and the public ended up doubting Kerry's record more than Bush's. I mean, this is just the brilliant kind of thing. It is the precursor to what is going on today in the election with all the mudslinging, especially in the GOP debates, where they're getting rougher and rougher with each other, and they will say almost anything to win. It is all the offspring of what we see with the Bushes in Family of Secrets.
It was just quite strange how he didn't really fit the profile of what someone to be a president would be.
Didn't fit it at all. But in their own ways, more and more of these people don't fit that profile. I mean, you'd like to think that a leader of a country, leader of the United States, would be somebody impressive, somebody thoughtful, somebody educated, experienced, visionary, with a certain amount of practical idealism. And, I mean, throughout our country's history, certainly we've had eloquent leaders. If you go back and you watch footage of whether Franklin Roosevelt or his Republican relative Theodore Roosevelt, or the Republican Abraham Lincoln, or the Democrat John F. Kennedy, I mean, these people brought a certain greatness to it. And what we're seeing now is just in recent years a diminution of our standards. And where that goes, only time will tell.
In your book, Family of Secrets, you also bring up some accounts of Watergate.
Yes, exactly. What happened was once I started digging into the Kennedy assassination and being fascinated to learn all these things about George H.W. Bush and why he couldn't remember where he was, I realize it's a little bit of a tease to your listeners, there's so much in the book about that, and I don't want to try to do a quick shorthand or a spoiler, but there is a reason to have 5 chapters on the Kennedy assassination in a book about the Bush family. By the same token, I then became interested in the entirety of George H.W. Bush's life, became interested in what he was doing when Richard Nixon was president and when Richard Nixon was ousted as a result of Watergate, and finding that, as with the Kennedy thing, that George H.W. Bush had a knack for being in the right place at the right time, and that CIA operatives were in the picture. People forget that many of the figures associated with Dealey Plaza in 1963 were also involved with the Bay of Pigs invasion, were also involved in the 1950s with the coup to overthrow the president of Guatemala, and in 1970s to overthrow Allende in Chile, and that those same people showed up in the Watergate burglary. And so I became very interested, and I saw that George H.W. Bush had been a supposed favorite of Richard Nixon, that he had appointed him to all kinds of posts that he didn't seem to be qualified for, or particularly well qualified for. Then I saw that when Nixon went down, George H.W. Bush had managed to maneuver himself to be the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And then he was supposedly helping Nixon, and then he basically sort of betrayed him at the last second. I said, what's going on here? I saw shades of the CIA again. And my research over the course of several years for Family of Secrets concluded that what I thought about Watergate was no more accurate than what I thought about the Kennedy assassination, that I had bought hook, line, and sinker, the establishment cover-up of what had actually happened, and that there were links between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination, that it was part of a pattern, and that what we were actually seeing was elements in our society becoming disenchanted with presidents. And I think this is the most telling thing of all, is that the wealthy interests in this country are not so partisan, per se. They're more interested in whether or not whoever is ostensibly in power is willing to do their bidding or not. And we see, whether it's a Democrat like Obama, who, when he runs for office, talks very much about reforming and then gets in and finds himself unable or unwilling to do many of the things he said he was going to do, or we see a Richard Nixon, who seemed to be a darling of the CIA and the Pentagon and everything, but when he got in, he began trying to chart his own course. And Family of Secrets, my book, has several chapters about all this background of Richard Nixon. I didn't realize that, not to make him out to be a choir boy or anything, but that things he did, like the he put all kinds of environmental measures into place, created the EPA, did certain things for workers. Although he was a cold warrior, opened the door to China and to missile treaties with the Soviet Union. The same kinds of things that, say, John F. Kennedy tried to do in his very short tenure. And so we see Nixon, a Republican who ran against Kennedy, also trying to institute in his own way certain, let's say, reforms, and running up against the same people saying, you can't do that. We don't want that. And then we see Richard Nixon starting to have problems, including Watergate, which, if you study it carefully, there is zero evidence that Richard Nixon was behind Watergate or even knew about it, which then raises the question, well, if he didn't know about it, who ordered it? And in Family of Secrets, I go through that whole thing, and you start seeing these same elements in the intelligence community doing things in Richard Nixon's name that end up harming him and not them.
Well, what's your take on E. Howard Hunt and his son talking about the deathbed confessions of, like, not only Kennedy, but he also talked about Watergate and even Dorothy Hunt?
Well, sure. And I actually spoke at a conference not too long ago, and I met Hunt's son, and as I recall, I even drove him somewhere. I remember it being in my car. But in any case, look, E. Howard Hunt was one of the most important players in what I'm talking about, that he was a member of a coterie of some, you know, I don't know if it's 5 or 20 or 50 or 100 people who were involved on the deepest levels in these sorts of covert operations. And things were so compartmentalized, I'm not sure that even a Hunt knew the whole picture. But they had a pretty good picture, and they understood that there were essentially coups going on, not just in all these other countries, but in this country as well. And they were part of the coup apparatus. They were for coups. That was the work that they did, just as there are people who are in the military who, when you're in the military, what do? I mean, one of the things you do is you kill people. And particularly in the Special Forces and Green Berets and things, they're taught how to sneak up on somebody and cut their throat. And, you know, when you leave the military, what kind of work do you do? Well, it's not hard to understand where your skill set lies. And so I look at people like Hunt and I say that, you know, this is what they did. Their morality was different than mine. I suppose they justified it somehow in their own minds, but humanity is capable of a tremendous range of behaviors.
Have you heard about the Obama's speech today about closing down Gitmo?
Yeah. I have. I haven't had a chance to study it in detail, but I mean, I think, you know, he promised to do that as a candidate. I think he wanted to do it, but again, referring you to our website, whowhatwhy.org. If you go in there and you type in the search box Guantanamo, it's hard to spell, or if you just put in Obama, I think one of the things we did, just put in Obama and Pentagon, and you will find out that in Obama's early presidency, when he attempted to do things like Guantanamo or to start removing troops from Afghanistan, things he had promised to do, he was checkmated. There were leaks put out that were very damaging to him. Those leaks were largely channeled through Bob Woodward at the Washington Post, and in Family of Secrets, my book, I reveal that Bob Woodward is not the person that people think he is, that his role in Watergate and in all of these things was never to be a reformer or a truth teller or a digger, that Bob Woodward's background was in naval intelligence, that Bob was essentially an asset of influence who was put into journalism wittingly by very high-level people, including the people who ran the Washington Post, so that he could be a propaganda vehicle for the establishment. And that makes sense when you begin to look at Watergate and you say, well, wasn't he a hero in bringing down a corrupt president? The answer is no. He was doing the bidding of people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and in the big defense contractors who saw the writing on the wall from Nixon and thought that this guy was way off of the reservation. And then you flash forward 40 years later, and there's still Bob Woodward, and he's basically doing the same thing. In this case, he's publishing stories that there's a sense in the Pentagon that Obama doesn't know what he's doing and he's making a mistake. And, of course, that angered Obama, but it clipped his wings, and so he had to bide his time. He saw that he couldn't do what he wanted, and so he sat there on his hands for 8 years, and what you're seeing today is him finally saying, okay, I've got a lousy and a mediocre legacy because I couldn't do the things I promised to do, and now it's maybe too late for them to really do much harm to me, and I'm not running again, and at this point I kind of doubt somebody's going to fire a gun from a tall building at me, so I'm just going to go for it, and I think he's going for it now.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how he's just sort of dropping these things, and you know, with Cuba and a lot of things, creating a lot of controversy.
Well, I think he's concerned that he's going to be seen as a, you know, sort of a Gerald Ford, a guy who didn't do a lot, and he did some things, but there aren't that many things people can tick off that are the kind of accomplishments that get into the history books, and so he's in a race now.
It's pretty. Speaking of Gerald Ford, there is a character too, right? You know, being on the committee for Kennedy, the Warren Commission, and being set in as president.
Well, yes, and not to sound like a broken record here, but in the course of my work for Family of Secrets, I learned a lot about Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was an asset of J. Edgar Hoover, and Gerald Ford, for whatever reasons, whether he was being blackmailed, which was a major tool and still is in power circles, he was very docile and very compliant, and so he was leaking things from the Warren Commission back to Hoover, who was involved, I think, in the cover-up. Pretty clear that he was involved in the cover-up of what really happened. And so Ford was always cooperative. Very importantly, when the Warren Commission was finalizing the report, he realized they had a problem, where the others realized that it was clear that there were more shots fired than Lee Harvey Oswald could possibly have fired from that gun and in that amount of time. And so they had that thing that Arlen Specter invented, the so-called magic bullet, this bullet that sort of danced around all these different ways through two different people and contorted itself and came out almost in perfect condition. No serious, really serious and open-minded analyst believes that bullet did all of that. And yet Ford changed the report because the bullet in the back was actually too low to have caused the wound in the throat, and so he changed the location of that bullet to say that it went in a place in the high upper back that if you look at your body, if you touch your high upper back and then you bring your hand around the same spot in the front, that could be a lower spot in your throat, and so he altered it. So Gerald Ford was always involved with cover-ups, and I met the man, a very nice man, a nice warm handshake, but he was really a bad guy, you know, and he spent his entire career doing the bidding of these elites, and, you know, he was very much a part of this thing to move Nixon out, but even he got in, and his own instincts when he was in power were to do some decent things, and I think he tried, and they didn't like him much, and some of those elites at some points kind of gave up on him. They brought in, this is very important, who did they bring in? They brought in George H.W. Bush to be the head of the CIA. I don't think that was Ford doing it. They brought in Rumsfeld and Cheney. People don't realize that Rumsfeld and Cheney, they think of him with George W. Bush, but actually decades earlier, those two men as very young figures were brought in to be his Bush's chief of staff and his defense secretary, and it was a kind of a little internal palace coup. People don't realize that because it's not in our history books, but that was really what was going on. And then Ford was kept to one term. Jimmy Carter then became the sponsor of the interests of these same elites. And then once Jimmy Carter got in, Carter decided not to do what they wanted him to do, and they became fed up with him. And then what happened to him? He was kept to one term. You know. And then we saw Ronald Reagan, who was the new shining hope of the elites, and they loved him because he was such a good actor, and like a Donald Trump, he could talk in a way that he made people feel good, even though much of what he said was actually just gibberish, was not really terribly bright or terribly well-informed, but he gave a great speech. And, you know, that's how people are. People respond to the tone of somebody's voice, what they look like, if they make them feel good. We're at root, we're fairly simple animals.
Did you have a different opinion of how 9/11 happened?
You know, on all of these things, our approach at Who, What, Why is to not make an assumption of any kind. We want to see evidence. And one thing I would refer you to on Who, What, Why, if you go in the search box and you type in 9/11 and Sarasota, the name of the city on the west coast of Florida, I think our main contribution to research in that area was to investigate what we found to be ties between the 19 alleged hijackers, most of whom were Saudi, and a very wealthy and extremely well-connected Saudi family living in Sarasota. Our research discovered that family who owned that house not only hosted some of the hijackers, but that they were directly employed by one of the most powerful princes in Saudi Arabia, a branch of the Saudi Arabian royal family that now are actually include the new king of Saudi Arabia. And so this is an enormous story. It's different. People confuse these things. They say, oh, I already know that. Well, they don't know that. They remember the story that a handful of young Saudi students were allowed to leave quickly. That's a different story. Okay, folks, nothing to do with this. Might be related somehow, but it's a different story. And it's a more benign story because there is a reason that if you were to take young people who were at certain colleges and things at that particular moment, that they might have been in some kind of physical danger. But our story is extremely important because it connects these alleged hijackers right up to the Saudi royal family. And that story was so explosive that the result was total silence. And what I mean by that is the media simply is incapable of handling really, really big, shocking stories. And so if you discovered something enormous about some very, very powerful person, they would never publish it. They would be interested in it, and they would want to get more research done, but they would only touch it when it was totally safe, when they felt that there was going to be no backlash and no professional risk to them to break the story. What the media likes is they like to be with the pack, but know where the pack is headed and be just slightly ahead of it. And so with the 9/11 story, there's certainly much more to the story. What do we make of all of these allegations that that there was a plot, that figures in the U.S. Establishment were complicit in that plot? We don't know, but at least we're honest enough to say that we don't know and that we do find holes in the official story. We know that 9/11 changed America and the world forever, that it was a tremendous boon to these corporations and their bottom line, which is very obvious if you read their annual reports. They were all terrified of the so-called peace dividend, which Clinton promised and was unable to deliver, that after the end of the Cold War, that we could reduce our armies and put our resources back into building America, building American people, education and infrastructure, which never happened. And they found these new bogeymen. We know the background is that Al-Qaeda and these outfits were largely created by the United States to do war with the Soviets. And it was a backlash against us. And so there's much, much more to that story. But again, we're not going to go with those people who, I believe, somewhat recklessly claim to know more than they know. I think there are certainly things to look at about how the buildings came down. It does look strange to me and to us, the way they came down. I think there's much more research to be done, but it needs to be done thoughtfully and carefully and responsibly.
So what's next for Russ Baker?
Well, you know, my day job, only about 12 to 15 hours a day, is trying to build whowhatwhy.org and to do shows like this and to encourage members of the audience to get active and to volunteer for us and to, if they can afford to please donate to support us and to keep building Who, What, Why. We would like to make it into a major news organization and your trusted source of news on a daily and even hourly basis. So that's a big focus for me. The other thing is I'm working on a new book. It is about John F. Kennedy and about the Kennedy assassination. I'm hoping it'll be out in a couple of years. It's, again, a result of many, many years of research and working with primary documents and sources who've never been interviewed before. Obviously, something that happened more than half a century ago, it's difficult to do detective work, but you can still do it. It's not entirely a cold case. And I believe the Kennedy assassination is solving that, is crucial to understanding why we don't have democracy in our country today. I am more and more convinced that that was a coup and that the people who overthrew Kennedy are the same people who overthrew Nixon, who prevented Obama from doing what he promised, and who support things like Citizens United, Supreme Court rulings that keep the rich people being able to finance the candidates. And I think we have to go back to the root of it, like a roto-rooter, and clear out the tubes from long ago in order to have them flowing properly today.
Our guest has been Russ Baker. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of whowhatwhy.org. Thanks very much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of the ZTalk Radio Network.
I'll be back.